The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary. It's your turn. It's Ask the Pastor on the Bible Study, underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. Good morning. I'm Paul Clayton. And KFUO Radio is a listener-supported broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Our phones are open at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our guest has been on KFUO in the past. Perhaps you've heard him on the phone on Studio A. Today he's in studio and we get to meet Dr. John Helwig from Emmaus Lutheran Church in St. Louis. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you here today.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your church, first of all. This is rather historic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Emmaus has got a fascinating history, really. Started back in the late 19th century, and was a mission plant from historic Trinity Soulard.
Just like Holy Cross.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like so many of the churches in the St. Louis area. Started out as the Jefferson Avenue Mission. Uh-huh. Fairly quickly was established as its own independent congregation, Emmaus Lutheran Church. Grew like gangbusters mm-hmm. in the early 20th century. We still have an absolutely beautiful, massive building, beautiful rock and that. But with the post-World War II boom and expansion out in the county, the church lost large membership, and then again in the 80s you had a similar phenomenon, and really shrunk down to, I understand, at the start of the 21st century, they were averaging about 12 people on a Sunday.
Goodness.
And now we're back to growing again, averaging in the 30s on a given Sunday, and so we've kind of gone from the Jefferson Avenue Mission back to being a Jefferson Avenue Mission again.
I see. And that's because the transition of the neighborhood has changed.
Yeah.
And the folks who worship there now, are they relatives of people who worshiped there in the past and they do this out of nostalgia? Or do they live in the neighborhood, walk to church? Or what's driving the growth now?
Most of the membership lives in the city. Mm-hmm. We're unusual in the city congregations that way. We do not have many people driving from the county. This is kind of ironic, but the person who drives the furthest to get to church every Sunday is myself, because I actually live in the county. I was living with my family out in Chesterfield before I was called to Emmaus, and uh-huh. so we just have kept our house there. But the growth is both people moving into the area and then some that live in the neighborhood. And that.
Is there a lot of diversity in that area now?
Extreme diversity.
Uh-huh.
It's very racially diverse, diverse in lifestyles. You have new immigrants and people who have lived there their entire lives and are in their 80s mm-hmm. and 90s. It's an extremely diverse neighborhood.
And does that pose some challenges for you? How do you make yourself relevant to the neighborhood? Are there things you do, programs, or just open the doors on Sunday?
Our biggest program trying to reach out to the neighborhood is we have a school supply giveaway in August. Uh-huh. It's August 13th, I believe, this year, in which we're presently in the process of trying to gather school supplies. And we always contact the St. Louis City School District to find out what school supplies are needed at different age groups.
Well, I bet they welcome that phone call, huh?
Yeah, they do. And then
they need that kind of help.
Yeah, and so then we have a big giveaway to those in the neighborhood. And again, it's really interesting because our immediate neighborhood is fairly depressed, although it is turning around. Mm-hmm. But then you get a little bit further out, and you have a lot of the regentrification happening. Some of it is happening in our immediate neighborhood as well. And so we have both some very depressed populations and have been historically depressed, and then you also have 20 and 30 young professionals who are moving in and rehabbing.
It's interesting how fascinated that generation is with that part of town. My daughter bought her first house, a condo in Lafayette Square. Grew up in the county, grew up in suburban America, and it looks like they want to see what that urban life is like.
Yeah, there's a real desire, I think, in that population for a feeling of community. Yeah, mm-hmm. I grew up in the suburbs here in St. Louis, mm-hmm. And I was actually in a very good neighborhood that I was in that I had friends, and you ride your bike around and get to know people. But I also found that sometimes you don't know all your neighbors, and that's been a trend becoming more and more so. So for a while, my wife and I lived, when I was in the seminary, we lived in St. Charles County. We knew our next-door neighbor on either side, and that was it.
That's about it. You pull into your garage, down goes the door, and you're in your own world.
Right, and so I think there's a desire for more of that community feeling, and so when you're in the city, you can't avoid one another. There is more of that community. There is more interaction. And so I think that's a lot of that appeal.
Interesting. Tell us about your family, and you're a Cardinal fan. You grew up in St. Louis. You have to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Married my wife, Denise, wonderful, supportive wife. We've been married, it'll be 19 years in August, and we have four wonderful children, Amanda, Rachel, Laura, and Nathan, bringing up the rear, ages ranging from 16 down to 7.
Is this your life's career or a second career as a pastor?
In essence, this is my career. I officially got tagged second career because I was out of college for 2 years before I started the seminary.
Oh.
But that wasn't really pursuing another career. It was a matter of my wife and I got married while in college. She took off her senior year in order to put me through. Then I took off after, put her through. Then Amanda was born. There you go. You got 2 years.
Uh-huh.
But I really didn't have a first career.
And then on to the seminary, and you received a doctorate. When was that?
I received a doctorate 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. In what area of study?
Historical theology, emphasis in the modern world.
Meaning what, 19th and 20th century?
Really kind of post-Reformation era.
Okay.
And on, although 19th and particularly 20th century is the area that I studied. My dissertation is on the American Lutherans' perceptions of pre-war Nazi Germany.
Hmm.
And so that's really...
Well, I would imagine you're a scholar on Walther as well.
Yeah. The Walther book, Law and Gospel, there's been a recent reissue of that from CPH, a retranslation in that. I actually wrote the biography of Walther for that work.
Oh, you did?
So, yeah.
And there's a movie being made.
Yes,
perhaps you were referenced for that, the Walther movie?
Not directly, no.
No, but maybe through the book. I know they did a lot of research putting that together.
Yeah.
And it looks real good so far. We've had a conversation with the director, and he went first class on this. He hired professional actors.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I'm excited to see it. So.
And I would also assume then that you know a lot about Mormonism. You're talking about that period of time.
Right.
You're studying other religions as well?
Not real broadly as far as into other religions, though I have done that, and particularly Mormonism possibly more than some of the others because of how it came out of the Second Great Awakening in the United States in the 18th century.
What was that? Can you, for the benefit of our listeners who may not be familiar with that title, that term, the Second Great Awakening?
Obviously, there's the assumption that you have a first great awakening, which was Jonathan Edwards and that kind of late colonial period.
Mm-hmm.
The second great awakening happened throughout, was a bit more stretched out, and happened throughout the era of the early to mid 19th century as the United States is expanding westward. And then you have a boom of traveling preachers and itinerant preachers.
Oh, okay.
And it's largely being moved and pushed in the more of the Baptist and Methodist traditions because they're able to grab preachers faster. There's not that large of a Lutheran presence in the United States at that point in time. There is some. But if you look at, say, a Lutheran, Roman Catholic, an Episcopalian, or Anglican, if you use the English term of it, there's a lot of study, a lot of preparation to go into making a pastor in one of these traditions. And so when you have this quick westward expansion, people moving out there, it's not easy to just suddenly grab men to send out there, but it's rather, okay, go to college, get seminary training. You're looking about 8 years for him from the time of feeling that call to going. Whereas within the Baptist and Methodist traditions, there's much more of if you feel led by the Spirit and have that anointing, you can go and do it. And as a result, it's much more pushed in that way, and there becomes a great theological diversity happening in the United States where we have much more of the Pentecostal movement coming up and things like that. And in that case, then you have Joseph Smith as one who is a part of that movement, who then his teachings diverged further and further until finally pretty much everybody else said, look, you're no longer within the Christian fold, and then the history goes of the Mormon migrations, etc.
So you've studied the emergence of the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Seventh-day Adventists and all of that?
Somewhat, yes.
Did that all emerge from the Second Great Awakening?
Yeah.
It did.
It's so much of this divergence that we have in Protestantism in America really ultimately comes out of that Second Great Awakening, because it's just, as we're having a population and a geographic explosion, and the church sort of explodes with it in all different directions as well, and the traditional oversights, etc., are gone. You know, obviously the European model does not fit in America. We do not have anybody who is officially overseeing religious teachings in a given area and that sort of thing. And really, even this is kind of traced back even in the founding of America, in that America was founded, we had all these different colonies, but each one had its own religious background, or a few of them none, but most of them had an official religion.
Puritans, Quakers.
Right. Then you had, for instance, the Puritans who didn't fit in Massachusetts and that, and are coming out of that, rather, the Baptists form Rhode Island. You have Anglicans.
And weren't the Catholics sort of like relegated to living on Rhode Island and elsewhere?
Maryland as well.
Maryland?
Yeah, that, you know, where the name comes from, Maryland. As well. But but you didn't have ones like the official crown colonies, particularly Virginia, and some of those where it's Anglicanism, or then called Episcopalianism. I'm sorry, then called it is Anglican. We now call it Episcopalianism in America. And but because we have the space that they didn't have in Europe, if you have a religious dissenter, they generally were persecuted and or executed. In America, because we had so much space, you could just kind of kick them out and they could go find their own place.
Find their own, well, which is what the Mormons did.
Right. And so that's where the Second Great Awakening is. You see that kind of on steroids as the population is moving westward and just expanding out there, those opportunities to just find your own niche, and obviously the most extreme being the Mormons, and they end up in Utah in their own area.
So basically, okay, as a layperson trying to digest this, it sounds like you've got a lot of amateurs out there that may have some charisma and attract a crowd, and but they're not trained. They're not theologically trained. They're not ready for the responsibility they have. And so then we slide off into these other faith systems, thinking of theology in different ways.
Right. Yeah, and what's happening there is that charisma, as you said, is the primary job description or qualification needed. And
because it's recognized as being filled with the Spirit or something?
Exactly. And likewise, during this time,
Perceived.
It's perceived as that way. And we have to understand as well that during this time, there are countless of these itinerant preachers who try it. And many don't succeed, and they just go back to farming or whatever the craft was before. And it's the ones who have enough charisma to be able to build up a following that then...
Survival of the fittest. I hate to use that term, but
yeah, and most of them would absolutely reject that as far as the, you know, the evolutionary theory. But it very much so is those who are able to build up a following succeed, and those who don't have the charisma don't succeed. And the things that we would look for as what would make a good pastor, obviously, we want somebody who has a certain amount of charisma, can share the gospel and be listened to, but we want training. We want somebody who understands the faith, someone who can study the word not only in an English translation, but in the Greek and Hebrew. We want some accountability and those sorts of things. That was all lost during that era.
Not many distractions as westward expansion began in these small communities. Not much going on. So I guess when one of these guys came into town and popped a tent, it was something to do.
Yeah, it was.
Almost like entertainment.
Yeah, it was. And that's something that's really changed for us, even in the church, in that the church historically had much more of an entertainment value. And by that, I don't mean that it was putting on a show, but rather people, we look back at even, say, the era of the Reformation, and we think, how in the world could people go in there and stand for a couple hour sermon? There was no television, there was no radio, this was.
And stained glass was pretty. I guess stained glass was like telling the story.
Exactly, exactly. And so, you can see that same dynamic happening with mm-hmm. this expansion in the Second Great Awakening, and that people are out there. And likewise, as there's this expansion, people are setting up in places, think Little House on the Prairie type world, because that's what this is mm-hmm. talking about. And there's often no pastor there. And then you have problems of both Christians who are hurting because they are not being fed with the Word, and they want to be fed with the Word. And then you also have people who are leaving that Christian morality and leaving that foundation because, again, they're not being fed, and there's not the overarching ethos of a Christian ethos in that area. So then when a traveling preacher comes in, there's a feeling like, wow, this is filling a void. And it draws a lot of attention.
And these traveling preachers, they didn't minister sacraments, did they? Did that fall by the wayside?
It varies greatly depending upon which
perhaps
group
other than
you're
baptism,
with.
But I'm but, wondering, yeah. They didn't do communion, did they?
Probably not. Likewise, again, we're looking at traditions where communion is seen as just a remembrance. Mm-hmm. And it's not seen as Christ's body and blood, and it's certainly not seen as giving us faith and life and building us up for salvation. And so as a result, if you can't make that work, well, that's not quite as big of a loss.
I've studied a little bit of the colonial period and religions, and I got the impression, maybe I'm wrong, that the Roman Catholics were not welcome.
For the most part, yeah.
How did they get so big? How did they explode? Where along the line was the tipping point? I mean, even when John Kennedy was running for president, that was an issue back then.
Right.
And yet
the
Roman Catholics have gotten so big in this country.
Largely the same way the Lutherans have, and that is immigration.
Mm-hmm.
Ireland,
Italy.
Exactly.
Germany.
And one of the things that's fascinating in American history is that as our history has shifted and immigration has shifted as far as where people are coming from, that also affects the religious face of America. And so, there's some scholars today who are pointing out that while immigration, again, is shifting the face of America, we're actually causing America not to become a-religious, as many people fear, but rather it's becoming more Roman Catholic because so much of the present immigration is coming from South America.
That's true.
From heavily Roman Catholic territories.
Mm-hmm. So you would disagree that America is becoming more secular?
It depends on how you define it, really. That's a really tough one. Probably the better way to put it is it's becoming more divided, and that the division between the secular and the religious is becoming exacerbated.
And also in there, in your studies and such, comes Darwinism, which has an impact on religion. And I've had pastors say that you've got a lot of faith in evolution to believe in it, and it's almost like a religion.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. In so many places, there is kind of some core beliefs that you have to buy into to be accepted within that fold. In the church, we talk about, of course, Christ's death and resurrection for our sake. Well, and for so many, it's evolution is that core belief that you have to hold to be accepted. And just this morning, my wife and I were talking about how it's interesting how there are some people who will argue that you cannot understand modern science. A lot of will say biology. Some will even go beyond that. And just you can't understand science without evolution. That's kind of given as the mm-hmm. belief that has to be held to be acceptable.
Did you also study, by the way, phones are open. I'm having a great conversation here, and you're answering all my questions. Let's bring in the listeners. 505-7850, 1-800-730-7850. 2727. Dr. John Helwig with us from Emmaus Lutheran Church in St. Louis. Dr. Helwig, along the way, did you study the Masonic orders?
Not too much, no.
No?
I mean, again, I'm kind of familiar with it, but didn't do any.
What about deism?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Did do a fair bit in deism, especially looking at colonial America and that era, and even coming
that's,
out of
that's the Europe. Age of Enlightenment, so-called Age of Enlightenment,
right.
Correct?
Right. And so there you've got that desire that God should be reasonable to us. You know, as reason is being more and more elevated, then there's kind of an emphasis God should be reasonable to us. We should be able to understand him. And then
making God in our image and likeness.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember who said it, but first said it, but it was said that, you know, in the beginning, God created man in his image, and man's been trying to return the favor ever since.
505-7850-1800-730-2727. Well, we're getting to know Dr. John Helwig. There's some issues in the news today. You want to tackle a couple of these? Gay history makes its way into California curriculum on Tuesday, a bill that would make the state the first to require textbooks and history classes to include the study of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans, as well as those with disabilities. Passed in the state assembly, the bill also bans material that reflects negatively on gays. On the whole, Republicans are against the bill, according to the Associated Press. Republicans refer to it as a well-intentioned but ill-conceived bill. Concerns are raised that it would indoctrinate children to accept homosexuality. If signed, the bill could take effect as early as the 2013-2014 academic year. It seems like every day we've got these gay issues in the news.
Yeah, we do. The homosexual lobby is very powerful, and they've done their homework as far as laying down the groundwork and building it up to push forward that agenda that they're pushing.
It almost seems to be a loose conspiracy to mainstream this alternate lifestyle.
Obviously, conspiracy is a little strong word, but maybe a loose conspiracy or whatever, but there is very much so a concerted effort to try and do mm-hmm. just that.
Mm. If you were in California and you had kids in school, what would you think of this?
Homeschool.
Homeschool.
You know, yeah. To be honest.
Yeah.
You know, because there comes a point in time in which you're just going to find yourself in such a battle between how you're trying to raise your children and the school is trying to say just the opposite.
And the culture is too.
Right, the culture is too. And so I always look at schooling as something where ultimately the Bible gives the responsibility to the parents, and the parents can rightfully delegate that, be it to a public school or to a parochial school or something like that. But when the parents are delegating it, it still should be a partnership where we're working together and to make sure that the children are educated. And here we're getting into a situation where it's not a partnership, but rather it's an antagonistic situation. And so
it's imposed.
Yeah.
Phones are open during the break, 505-7850-1800-730-2727. We'll take your questions on KFUO Radio when we return. It's Ask the Pastor, underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, on the Bible Study.
Concordia Seminary has four core values, and one core value is excellence. People today demand the very best. Even people who ignore or misrepresent God's word of truth often strive for excellence. So shouldn't we strive all the more for excellence in our churches and seminary? Pastoral leaders will hold excellence high, helping invite people to the truth of our message.
At KFUO Radio, we receive emails from all over. Recently, we received this one from Kathleen in Arkansas. I love your programs and cannot begin to tell you how much it means to me to have the Bible study and Wrestling with the Basics, and I am exploring all the rest. For some reason, I am unable to listen to them live, either at work or at home. Nobody seems to be able to figure out why, so I am very thankful for the archives. God's richest blessings as you continue to reach out to a hurting world, in Jesus' name. Thank you, Kathleen, for your email contribution.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Those who advocate for abortion on demand have no persuadable argument on the hearts and minds of the American people. Public opinion continues to erode. As a result, we've seen wide-scale evidence of a new strategy to win the public debate. They're trying to silence the pro-life message. Here's proof. A British Columbia elementary student did a speech on abortion. During regional competition, the school boycotted her presentation. Pro-life billboards in New York City and Los Angeles have been removed just days after going up. Memorial crosses erected at universities to note the toll of abortion are routinely vandalized. Planned Parenthood just lost an effort to have YouTube censor pro-life videos by student activists, and the list goes on.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org. And stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Court order. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. A federal appeals court has ordered the U.S. government to immediately stop enforcing the ban on openly gay troops in the military. A three-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco noted that Congress moved to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in December. Under the law, passed and signed by the president, the repeal would take effect 60 days after the president and his senior defense advisors certify that lifting the ban won't hurt troops' ability to fight. Family Research Council President Tony Perkins notes that hasn't happened yet.
The military is not ready. And so for the court to step in is an issue of national security here that's at risk.
Perkins says it's also unclear
the impact that it's going to have on religious freedom, the impact it's going to have upon chaplains.
But gay rights advocates hailed the ruling against what they consider unfair discrimination. I'm Steve Coleman.
We need a word today, one that speaks the truth, yes, calling us to repent of our sin, but in love. We need a word today, one that refreshes, that renews our very hearts and souls. We need a word today from God, and we have that word.
Pastor Gregory Seltz, this week on The Lutheran Hour.
Sundays at 12:30 and 5 p.m. on KFUO Radio.
We offer a wealth of audio resources at kfuo.org. You can download podcasts of entire programs like The Bible Study, Studio A, Law and Gospel, and Wrestling with the Basics. You can also download segments of Morning Essentials and short-form programs like The Meyer Minute, By the Way, and Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon. KFUO podcasts are just a click away. Visit kfuo.org or subscribe through iTunes. It's Ask the Pastor on the Bible Study. Phones open at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. John Helwig from Emmaus Lutheran Church in St. Louis, taking your questions and comments this morning. So when you answered me about homeschooling those kids, you knew what you were talking about. That's what your family does, huh?
Yes. Yeah, we homeschool, have all the way through.
And how many children and what ages?
There are four children, ages 16, 14, 10 and 7.
And how long have you been doing that?
Since the beginning. With our
what a commitment.
Daughter. Yeah. Yeah. It's
Did that take some prayer?
A lot of prayer. Not just at the beginning, but throughout. It's a labor of love, but it is definitely a labor.
Do the kids feel the same way? Do they like it?
Yes, they do.
They do?
They do.
They don't feel like they're being deprived of a normal, quote, normal childhood or something?
No. And very active, actually. My oldest daughter, for instance, plays on a homeschool basketball team.
Uh-huh.
And they go to compete and compete well against other homeschool teams. They play against parochial schools in the area. They went to the Nationals this year.
Uh-huh.
And did quite well there. My second eldest daughter is hoping to start playing for a homeschool soccer team this next year. She's starting high school, and we're involved with some homeschool co-ops and other stuff. And so the idea of the stereotype that's out there of homeschoolers being kind of in their own little world and totally.
There's plenty of socialization.
Yeah, there's plenty.
And extracurricular activities.
Yeah, so. Our problem is not a lack of socialization. Our problem is an overlarge schedule that we're trying to balance.
Uh-huh. Do you find teachable moments in the culture that you bring up?
Oh yeah.
When you're schooling your kids.
Oh yeah, there's always things that are coming up from things in the news or even the music that they listen to or whatever, uh-huh. and that sort of thing that you try and bring up. And
the culture's coming at them from all directions.
Oh, it is, and we're trying really teaching them to think critically, mm-hmm. and so it's been a little while, but we've taken them say to the zoo here. It's, of course, St. Louis got a fabulous zoo, but there's the one section where they have the Darwin exhibit and all of that, and so occasionally I'll take them through and we'll talk about it and kind of, okay, what are the facts and what what assumptions are they laying behind all of this, mm-hmm. That are they pushing? What kind of a message is being told in that?
And I'll bet you've taken your kids on a lot of field trips, and no matter where you go, whether it's the science center, the zoo, maybe it's a conservation department exhibit. I know down at Elephant Rocks, there it is, mainstreaming of evolutionary theory.
Oh, yeah.
Go up to Hartford to that confluence of the Missouri and Mississippi rivers and that beautiful tower they have there. If you watch the video before you go up in the tower, there's some evolution stuff in there. It's just about everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
And your kids can tell the difference, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, my older two, a couple years ago, I actually had them set up a debate over creation and evolution. My oldest was not happy that I made her argue the evolution side, but they did well with it. But I wanted them to try and work with that as far as the looking at the arguments for and against and really try and deal with it intellectually. We're not trying to shelter them from it, but rather teaching them to interact with it and be critical of it,
mm-hmm.
and to think about it.
And no doubt you also talk about church and state issues with the kids, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And two kingdoms.
Yeah, two kingdoms, and church and state. And a lot of it is through the history, teaching them history and how things have gotten, where they are and that sort of thing. So this past year, as we ended history, we ended with the founding of the United States and then the Constitution, and so kind of talking about how a lot of these issues arose and were debated and decided on there.
I mentioned to you during the break that when I first came here in 1993, there was a real push on in some Christian circles, evangelical circles, for prayer in public schools. And with the emergence of Islam, in this country especially, that's kind of gone by the wayside. Whose prayer? What prayer?
Yeah. There are still some who are pushing for prayer, but it's becoming, I think, a more dangerous situation because, the question is then who prays?
And who are you praying to?
Right. Back when there was prayer in schools regularly and throughout most of the history of our nation, the assumption was that if you're praying either to the Christian God or to a deist form of that is still very closely related, because it's fascinating that even our founding fathers that were deists, so a lot of them were Christians, but some of them were deists, such as Jefferson or Franklin, their view of deism is very much so a Christian-influenced deism. And so there's always that assumption that it was the Christian God that you're praying to, maybe some slightly different understandings of how we were going to define it, but at least that, whereas today, now, we have...
You're going to pray to the Western God? Are you going to pray to the Far Eastern God or the Islamic God?
Right. While it's not happening in the public schools, it is happening in, state chambers and... town councils in that, where sometimes they are having, a Muslim imam come in and give the opening prayer.
Meanwhile, in some places, you're urged not to use words like God bless and Jesus Christ. Case in point, Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison is calling for an investigation into the actions of the Houston National Cemetery director, who told pastors and veterans group to stop using phrases like God bless and Jesus Christ during funeral services. Several veterans groups and pastors in the Houston area filed a religious discrimination lawsuit this week, charging that the cemetery's director, Arlene Ocasio, was censoring prayers and certain religious terms at funerals for veterans. Two other senators have already called for Ocasio to step down. Hutchison is asking the Veterans Affairs Secretary to investigate the circumstances surrounding Ocasio's actions. Seems like we're giving carte blanche to other religions, and then people are cracking down on Christians.
It certainly seems that way at times, yeah.
Do you think that, is this a church and state issue? Or is this just one person who used their influence and their personal preferences to override these pastors?
Well, obviously her primary concern is a church-state issue. And I haven't read a whole lot about it. I don't know how much she's trying to censor pastors. I know she's trying to censor the government workers. I know that the some of the soldiers who have overseen funerals at the end would say something like, God bless you, mm-hmm. or the ladies auxiliary would have things like, we're praying for you, in some of their notes. And I know that she's banned that, but I can't say that I've read enough about it to know about
any. Well, the lawsuit centers on a report that Ocasio censored a prayer that the Reverend Scott Rainey had planned to deliver during a service at the cemetery, removing the name of Jesus from the prayer. Rainey filed suit, and a federal judge granted a temporary restraining order against Veterans Affairs, ruling that Rainey's prayer qualified as free speech protected under the First Amendment and allowing him to proceed with his original prayer. However, VA officials have continued to violate free speech rights, say pastors and veterans.
So, well, okay, I hadn't heard about that part, but yeah, so there it is, trying to censor pastors. And the same thing is happening in schools where you have, you know, say some schools will allow a pastor to speak at the graduation or offer a prayer, but then there's definite guidelines. You can't say the name of Jesus and things like that that are put on there as well. And so,
yeah, we have a house chaplain in Congress.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's fascinating how that history is there. It's built into so much of it. You have so many of these things where even things like the prayer in school issue, when that came up, and these things, and questions in the courts, and yet he was giving the ultimate decision, but the Supreme Court, who is literally sitting underneath a huge engraving of the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. So there's, we've definitely, you know, kind of on again, off again, and inconsistent as a society with this right now. But the challenge is, how do we act in this situation without an established religion for our nation?
As our country was founded and grew and expanded, what about Judaism in America? Did you study that?
It historically has been fairly small minority. There has been Jews throughout the history of the United States. Especially in the earliest time period, though, it was a very small group, mm-hmm. Who, again, because of the size of the country, there was sort of an attitude of, well, you can do your thing, you just stay in your own little corner and do it. And that was how it happened for a long time, and then more immigration has then changed that and brought in more, so we now have a larger Jewish population in the United States.
Who call themselves Jews by identity, but we hear that they're largely secular.
Yeah.
And liberal.
Yes. To be a Jew, the official definition is if your mother was Jewish, you're Jewish. Obviously, there's nothing that is inherently religious in that whatsoever. And so Judaism for many Jews in America, not all by a long shot, but for many of them, it is just more of a cultural identity mm-hmm. thing.
Is there any evangelism led by Jews, or do they not do that?
There isn't too much evangelism being led by Jews. I don't know a whole lot about it, to be honest, but you figure the largest Jewish population in the United States and really in the world is from the Reform tradition of Judaism, which is the Jewish equivalent of liberal Christianity. And so they are not really trying to convert others, because the goal is more of you want to live a moral life, believe that there is a God or whatever, but there's not really a great offense or disagreement with, say, a liberal Christian. And in fact, often some of the liberal Christian churches and Reformed Jews will have clergy from those other traditions come to their worship services and that.
Meanwhile, did you also, I'm just fascinated by your knowledge of history, many of the slaves became Christians.
Yes.
Here in America. And did you study that phenomenon?
A little bit. You know, I'm certainly not an expert in it, but it is fascinating.
They weren't Christians when they were captured in Africa, were they?
Right.
And then how did that happen? Because they became more Christian than some of the settlers.
Yeah, they really did. It was a combination of things. You had some where you actually had the owners, the slave owners, who would bring the slaves to church.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, though, the churches were segregated, and there was a balcony or a back area where the slaves were allowed, and they weren't allowed to mingle with the white population. So you had some of that, but then you also had some Christians who really believed that these people need the gospel. They need to know Christ for their salvation. And so they set up, and there were a lot of really underground slave churches where the churches were being run on the plantation. Often the pastors were blacks, very often a slave himself, and that. And some of these were underground because you had Christian, or rather you had masters who, because American slavery was a racist slavery, which is, makes it different than most slavery in history, and I think in a lot of ways makes it worse. But it was a view that these are inferior. Well, to say that they should hear, receive the gospel as well is, in a way, to make them equals. And it's not surprisingly that
there was some resistance to that.
There was some resistance, and to a certain extent, they were right in that the abolition movement came out of the Christian communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, you had some that were trying to suppress that movement, but then there was that religion. And the slave and even the post-slavery black or African-American Christianity focused a little bit differently on parts of the Bible than, say, the whites did. And that makes sense, because what they really did is they identified more with Old Testament Israel. And you know, for you and I, we look at the Exodus and we think about, okay, this is a key event. This is God proving that he is the true God and not all of the false gods of the Egyptians. This is God making himself a people. This is also a precursor to Christ and mm-hmm. and that. Whereas for those who are actually in slavery, they can resonate with the people of Israel in slavery far more than you and I ever could. And so the idea of a God who loves his people and brings them out of the land of slavery, that's something that's very real to them and very potent to them. And I think that's one of those aspects that of Scripture that they understood better than you and I do.
If God could free the Israelites, maybe he'll free us.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, a lot of the Negro spirituals really take that sort of a tenor.
Uh-huh.
Of, you know, swing low, sweet chariot, coming to take me home, you know, take me out of this slavery into the promised land, either the promised land of freedom or the promised land ultimately of heaven. That sort of thing, there is, you know, very strong emphasis because they recognized their own slavery and their problems, whereas sometimes we've got it too good. And, you know, and then the plantation owners and that, where don't always recognize our need for Christ and salvation, in that, you know, things are going well. And yeah, I want to be saved. I want to, don't want to go to hell. I want to go to heaven, all that sort of thing. But there's not the same yearning as when you're in captivity.
Hmm.
And so there's better appreciation for it.
I can really understand that. And so Christianity caught on with the African Americans. Meanwhile, there must have been missionaries trying to convert Native American Indians in this country, it didn't catch on there.
Right.
Is that because they identified Christianity with this antagonistic behavior from the white man? Much like Muslim countries, Muslims in general, associate Americans with Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of it has to do with, I think, combination as far as the difference between them, but has to do with order of events.
Mm-hmm.
For many of the Indians, what you'd have is you would have someone who would become a missionary to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would have the white man end up oppressing them.
And conquerors.
So, conquerors who are kicking them out, who are you know, mistreating them and breaking their promises. And so you had actually settlements in the colonial period of Indians who were actually taking on English ways and living like an English village and being taught Christianity. And then when they're being attacked, say in the French and Indian War or in other Indian conflicts or whatever, the colonial army is not coming out and protecting them, and they're being just allowed to slaughter. Or then you have the other ones where, and you know how the whole history is with the Indians, and that the white men would come to them, make promises, make treaties, and that treaty would last until the white man wanted more land.
And then the bond of trust would break.
And right. And so then when you have another one of these men coming to you saying, I want to tell you about my God, they're initial response is, is this the God that tells you to break your promises and that sort of thing? Whereas for those who were in slavery, it was more of they were abused and mistreated first, and then you had compassionate people coming in afterwards and saying, we're not all like this. We have compassion for you. We want your salvation and your welfare. And so I think there was a bit more receptivity for that. Likewise, there was also more of a breakdown of their old religion and their old culture, which made it easier for them to convert.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jan, you're on KFUO Radio with Dr. John Helwig.
Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Hi, Pastor. I'm really enjoying our conversation. Can you tell us about Dr. Rosie Young?
I'm afraid I'd know the name, but I don't know a whole lot about her. I really can't go too far into that.
She founded the college in the South. Was it Alabama, Jan?
Yeah. She actually, I wasn't there, so I don't know much about her either, but I had heard that she was an LCMS educator who founded 30 rural schools, a high school, and a junior college in, which I guess later was the became Concordia Selma. And the reason I mention her is because she was born after slavery, but she had a heart for education, and she appealed to Booker T. Washington, who, founded Tuskegee, and she was like looking for money. And he said, well, I don't have any, so why don't you check with the Board of Colored Missions of the Lutheran Church? And so I think what ended up happening was the Missouri Synod sent a pastor to evaluate her, and they funded these churches or these schools. And later she became an LCMS educator. But
CPH has the book Hero of Faith, Rosa Young, by the way. It's available through CPH for about $8, and it's written by Christine Wiertz.
And I have to confess, it's on my shelf, and I haven't gotten around to reading it yet.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's interesting because there is a moment in time when you can release the oppression and the, the just feeling of weight where you can tap into a personal faith and you have a testimony. You know, Psalm 107 says, let the redeemed of the Lord say so. And if you ever read that psalm, he's talking about traumatic experiences that only God can get us out of. And once we get out of them, we need to praise him for his mercy. And like I said, I'm enjoying this. And continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our guest is Dr. John Helwig from Emmaus Lutheran Church in St. Louis. So what else is planned for your church, Emmaus, this year? You're going to get involved in the back-to-school effort there in the city of St. Louis with some supplies for kids. And how do you fund that effort?
Almost entirely through donations. Mm-hmm. Both we take monetary and largely in-kind donations. We have some help from CPH as they have a school supply giveaway as well, and so we're able to partner with them in that they're buying, for instance, I believe especially paper, large quantities of paper for the school supply giveaway, and so we can. We have a couple members who are employees of CPH, and so through them we're able to tack on to that order and get the bulk discount with them. And but otherwise, you know, we're looking for donations and that. And unfortunately, I don't have the list right in front of me of what all we're looking for. We're still trying to finalize some of that of what we need.
But if a listener wants to pitch in and help, has a heart for that kind of thing, they can contact you at the church.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we would appreciate any assistance that could be given.
What's it like for your children living in Chesterfield to come into the city on Sunday and go to church in an urban setting?
I guess it's a better question for them than it is for me, but you know, they're fairly comfortable with it, which is interesting because my previous parish was a dual parish in small town Nebraska, and so it's a big change in that regard, but you know, there's a certain amount.
Do they embrace the diversity of the neighborhood and that kind of thing?
Yeah, they do. Uh-huh. They do. Don't think too much of it, really. We had a Hispanic family coming for Sunday school, and they assisted with that, and my older daughters did. And but yeah, and they appreciate that diversity. We also have a family that is from China, mm-hmm. that are members, and they help with them, and so. Yeah, they're used to that diversity. It's just, you know, these are the people that are here, and so that's who's a member of the church.
Before you go, give the location of Emmaus and your worship time on Sunday.
All right, we're at 2241 South Jefferson, which is on Jefferson, probably about five blocks south of 44, if you head down to CPH. And we have Sunday school in our school building at 9 a.m., and then 10:30 we have our Sunday worship.
Mm-hmm. Are you north of where Gravois crosses Jefferson?
Just a little bit, yeah.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, at the corner of the school's on Shenandoah, actually. We're at the kind of the corner of Shenandoah and Jefferson, although the church actually is at Armand and Jefferson, but it's right in that area.
Okay, well, thank you for being with us today. Blessings to you and your ministry.
All right, well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
That's the Bible Study Ask the Pastor. We thank you for listening. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, and KFUO Radio is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.